Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Wisdom versus knowledge, tradition versus consumerism. An absolutely fascinating conversation with Lindy Man. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up and welcome to Wednesday. As always, I hope you will leave me a comment, leave me a review. Subscribe to the Will Cain Podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment. Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. You remember some time ago in an episode of the Will Cain Podcast, we talked about refinement culture. Refinement culture was the idea that over time, everything becomes monotonously the same. From sports to architecture, no diversity. The proponent of that theory, refinement culture, is a man who goes by the handle Lindy Man. His name is Paul Skalas. Paul is someone who has forwarded the idea of the Lindy effect. The Lindy effect is, in essence, that you can give value or you can make a prediction about the staying power of something based upon how long it's been around. If something's been around for 5 years, you can expect it to last another 5 years. If something's been around for 500 years, you can expect it to last another 500 years. It's sort of giving you the value of tradition and wisdom. I find this eminently fascinating. Paul can be found on Twitter, by the way, at PaulSkalas. You can also subscribe to his newsletter, which I recommend, at lindynewsletter.beehive.com. That's L-I-N-D-Y newsletter.beehive.com. You can find that URL on his Twitter feed at Paul Skalas. I asked Paul in this conversation to go through several of his theories, including stuck culture. The idea that we haven't changed really much since about 2005, since the advent of YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, social media. I asked him to talk to me about refinement culture. I pushed back and asked whether or not we just move towards optimization. And that may be true, but then do we lose variety as the spice of life? And we talked about whether or not valuing something that's 500 years old, which there's a movement afoot to do, whether or not it means in our diets, in our exercise, in our daily habits, in our health choices. If it is a rule, if it's an instinct, Paul several times in our conversation uses the word heuristic. I thought it worthy to define heuristic. Heuristic is an adjective or a noun. The noun is a heuristic process or method. The adjective then is one, enabling someone to discover or learn something for themselves, or two, proceeding to a solution by trial and error or by rules that are only loosely defined. What you'll find here, as we talk about the Lindy effect, is an instinct, I think, a way to go about daily decision making, a way to observe the water that you as a fish are swimming in. Am I in a stream? Am I in a jet stream? If I'm in a plane, am I floating along the surface? Am I a part of a trend? Or am I a part of something that truly has long-term human value? I think it's a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Lindy Man. All right, Paul, I just got done asking you, do you want me to call you Paul or do you want me to call you Lindy Man? And you said to me, whatever I want. So, in sort of an open embrace of the rejection of refinement culture, I'm going to call you Lindy Man because it's more unique. I'm not going to run into many Lindy Mans, but I'm going to run into many Pauls. So I like going with what is uniquely you.
Nice. I like it. Yeah. You don't hear about a lot of nicknames these days, right? I mean, back in pro wrestling, everyone had a nickname, but you know, nowadays, not so much.
And I picture 1800s America. There's just being a lot of Slims walking around, you know, and today there's not, to your point, there's not a lot of nicknames. Describe your physical appearance. But that's not...
Be like, hey, that's the chief. That's boss. That's yeah. all, you know, he barely knows names.
All right, man, I'm excited to talk to you. And I just referred to you as Lindy Man. And so for much of the audience, we need to figure out why that is and what that means. The New York Times has written an article about you talking about the Lindy effect. So tell us why you are Lindy Man and tell us what is the Lindy effect.
Yeah, sure. So I was reading a book maybe 10, 15 years ago by a writer named Nassim Taleb. He's a statistician, philosopher. He used to be a trader, made hundreds of millions of dollars, retired, and said, I'm going to write books now. You know, I made my money. So, and he writes great books, so you should read them. So I first learned about this heuristic, and it's a heuristic. It says the longer something has existed, the longer it will continue to exist. And it's been developed in, you know, I think he got it from someone else who was talking about a play that was on Broadway for 100 days. Then it's going to be on Broadway. You can bet that it will be on Broadway for another 100 days after that kind of thing. So if you kind of take that heuristic, right, and you kind of utilize it for other domains, other purposes, you can, you know, for non-perishable items, right? For a human, if you've been around for 50 years, you're probably not going to be around for another 50 years, right? Humans die, biological systems die, but for pieces of art, for, you know, literature, for ideas, for, you know, patterns of life or food, you know, or diet or liquids, you can utilize this filter. You can have this in your back pocket to sort of, you know, see what's going on in this hyper-artificial world we're in. And we are in a hyper-artificial world. You know, this is not the world of the 1950s. This is definitely not the world of the 1850s, you know, and some of that is good. But some of this bad too. So if you have this filter over, you know, what's lasted, what's being changed, I think it could help out someone in life a little bit. Because, you know, one of the things we've done in this world is create a real playground for products, right? And that's great. I'd love to be in a world where I'm getting thrown tons of options, tons of choices, right? But some of those choices might kill you, like the cigarette, right? The cigarette came by 1920. It had about a 70-year run and then, you know, killed a bunch of people. And now we're done with the cigarette. We've moved on. You know, that got tested by those people, right? This new product, this daily tobacco kind of use with additives, caused some harm. And, you know, now we're not smoking anymore as a society. You know, some people are. We moved on to nicotine gum or to vapes, but generally you don't see people smoking like they did in the 60s, in the sense, because we found out there was a filter there. Well, instead of going through the consequences, you could have said, well, this is like a non-Lindy product. I don't want to be a gerbil here. I don't want to be tested by this product, by this corporation that's making a lot of money. I'm just going to let this come and go throughout my life. Or if I'm going to partake in it, I'm going to make sure I don't get addicted to it and keep doing it daily. So, you know, that's one way to utilize it, you know, but there's tons of domains you can utilize this heuristic in. You just have to, you can't have a history blindness. You got to know how people have lived, and you got to go in and got to read old books. You got to read books about how people lived and talk to older people from another generation. I think I started posting about it on Twitter, started playing around with it, with architecture, with diet, with exercise, with a whole host of different domains, and people enjoyed it. You know, the New York Times came by. They said, we're interested in writing about it. You know, writing about you. I think it was during the pandemic, you know, and you know, in a way that pandemic kind of shocked a lot of people because we were living outside of history. A lot of people thought we're done. We're on the way to, you know, getting rich. Everybody's going to be happy. Nothing's bad's going to happen. But no, I mean, bam, a pandemic came out of nowhere, just like it does every 100 years. And you could probably expect one in another 100 years. So.
You know, so I think we're going to spend the bulk of our conversation on the philosophical principle of giving weight to tradition and wisdom. That's what I take away from understanding the value of antiquity. And you, it's said well in that New York Times profile of you, but the value of antiquity in response to consumerism. And I want to spend the bulk of our conversation on that. It's intuitive to me and it seems to hold self-evident value. But as to the specifics of the Lindy effect, I guess that one's harder for me to wrap my mind around. And in reading about it in the specificity of why it's called the Lindy effect, it did talk about that diner that comedians and performers went to in, I don't know, the 60s or 70s in New York City. And they set up that somewhat mathematical formula that you just laid out for us, that basically at any point in given time, it seems like we're looking at something at its half-life, that you're suggesting if it's been around for 500 years, it'll be around for another 500 years. If it's been around for two, count on it lasting for another two. And like you said, this is for perishable things, ideas, businesses. But I have trouble with that because it says, as though the moment in time we are sitting is the perfect 0 point assessment. You know, like if we were two years into a new innovation, you would always say it's got two more years, even if that's a 500 year prospect. So I don't really get the exact mathematical idea that we can look at something's past to project its future.
Well, you don't have to get into the mathematical kind of idea of it. You can get in the risk domain, right? The risk domain is, you know, we saw this with the pandemic, which is, do I wear a mask when this virus is in the air? Yes, I do. Do the masks work? I don't know. But in other pandemics, they wore masks. In, you know, the 16th century Italy, everybody's wearing masks around everywhere, you know, and you know, you have to make a choice in the risk domain whether, you know, this is going to hurt you, how long this is going to be. You know, it's the same thing with eating Cheetos or McDonald's every day. You know, this type of food that's been engineered for us has never really existed. I mean, some of it, it's very tasty. It's very good. But, you know, eating it every day is probably going to cause you problems. So I think you need to take a step back from the mathematical kind of, hey, you know, obviously things are going to die in 10 years that start 10 years ago. I mean, it's not 100%. Nothing in the social sciences is 100%. But you have one life and, one way of living. And it has outsized impact on your life if you're wrong. So you just need to have that in the back of your head that we're changing things. And these changes are not in continuity with the past. They're unprecedented. And what are they going to do to me, my mind, my psychological mind? Like, you can even take a smaller thing like ceiling height. You know, ceiling heights in America are pretty low. You know, they're about 8 foot, 7 foot. Sometimes you'll get 9. You look at ceiling heights from, you know, 100-year-old buildings, they're building them 11, 12, you know, foot high, and you walk into a high ceiling environment, it feels good. You feel like you can think better. You know, I think the human can feel the air above his head much more than the air around him, you know, the space around him. And I think that's sort of, we've lost that pattern because we want to sort of insulate everybody into these homes that don't, you know, they don't have drafts. They, you know, it's air conditioning, heat. We can control everything. It's gonna be cheaper on your bill, but you're getting rid of an ancestral pattern here that our ancestors kind of said, yeah, 11-foot ceilings, that's pretty good for living. That we're gonna have that. So that's one example. But generally, getting bogged down into the minute details of the mathematical equation, I think you're missing the point of the value that this gets with seeing change, how changes happen in our society, and being and asking yourself, why are we changing this?
You know, I don't think I'm missing the value. I think that you're skiing downhill when it comes to me. Trust me, I'm bought in on the concept, but it's the nature perhaps of the legal education, but also wanting to, you know, plug every hole in the dam to play somewhat devil's advocate or to answer my obvious questions about it. And I get that it's a heuristic. It's not a hard and fast rule. It's a guiding principle for risk assessment. And it makes the most sense to me when you're talking about things like culture and business. I'm a big Warren Buffett fan, and Warren Buffett invests in businesses that have a proven track record and doesn't invest in things that are new and that he does not understand. I remember reading this book, I believe it was Sonic Boom by Greg Easterbrook, and he was talking about KKR, the famous venture capital firm, and he said, we don't invest in pioneers. Meaning we don't invest in MySpace. Pioneers get scalped. We invest in settlers, those that come along after the fact and the track record is somewhat proven. And so what we're talking about is, I think in your estimate, a risk assessment model of looking at wisdom and things that have been proven. I have more trouble, and I'm going to get to the parts where I'm not playing devil's advocate, I promise you, in just a moment. But I have more trouble with, for example, medicine, and like you talking about masks during the pandemic, because that seems to be an area where innovation outpaces traditional wisdom. So, for example, we were letting blood with leeches at one point, right? And now we know that that wasn't curing anything. And we may have worn masks with the Spanish flu, you know, 100 years ago, or even further back, as you point out. But we pretty much now know the science as well that the masks didn't do much of anything when it comes to COVID. So I see the practical applications in so many aspects. Again, I think that's going to be the bulk of our conversation. But I don't see it, for example, in medicine.
Yeah, so medicine is an interesting domain. Medicine has, you know, obviously germ theory, there's been incredible advancements in medicine in the last 200 years. And, you know, someone would say, well, medicine before 200 years ago is complete, you know, nonsense. And in a way, they're right, because I wouldn't want to go to a doctor 200 years ago. But what they focused on 200 years ago was not getting sick in the first place, which is prevention, right? And now we're not playing the prevention game. We're playing the, you got sick, now we got to intervene. So we got to intervene with statins, we got to with cholesterol, we got to intervene with all types of things. And yeah, people get cancer and chemo, and you should definitely go to doctors for serious illnesses. But, you know, when you're intervening, you can cause other harm too, you know, and instead of having a medical opinion of, hey, let's not get sick in the first place, which ancient medicine was all about that. You know, we've moved to let's fix it. So we have this incredibly large medical industry that's, you know, fixing a lot of real problems. I'm not some sort of anti-medical guy, or, you know, I don't even use the Lindy effect in the medical domain. I say just ignore it there, because, you know, if you're sick or whatever, just go get help. But generally, we shouldn't be going to the hospital and doctors all the time, man. Like, our bodies, unless we're really sick, and that's when right. You should go. But generally, I don't try, you know, we should be living a life where that's not necessary. And obviously, it does come up and you need to go, but we should be moving toward more of a prevention and sort of eating certain foods, exercising. And I think getting, you know, how much of why we're going to the doctor is problems of a artificial world with not moving around, eating bad, of, you know, just getting in a car wreck, right? Getting in a car wreck. There's no such thing as cars before. So getting into this 70-mile-an-hour crushed accident with another vehicle is going to put you in the hospital, right? Me walking into you, because we're both walking in a city, none of us are going to go to the hospital from that collision. So there's a lot of things that are escalated today. And, you know, you can even look... You can even drill deep down. Like, there's a guy that does seed oil. He's talking about seed oils now, these vegetable oil, canola oil in our fries and all our food. He thinks that could be an issue with heart health too. So as long as we're intervening in our society, we're causing a more sicker society that would cause more medical issues. But yeah, generally, I don't really utilize Lindy in the medical domain.
I think you're exactly right, by the way, about refocusing health on prevention instead of medicine. You're talking about, at least he goes by the handle Carnivore MD, the guy who has made his case on rejecting seed oils. I follow him as well. Yeah. I understand completely. Talk to me about when I first came across you, was one of your posts on refinement culture, and I found it absolutely fascinating. Tell me about refinement culture.
Yeah, it's sort of this broad term I use to kind of talk about something happening in a lot of domains, which is like the removal of variety. You know, there's a lot of talk about diversity in the media, but I'm talking about a different diversity, which is diversity of expression, a diversity of aesthetics. And you can see it everywhere once you kind of dig into the data. You know, if you look at what color the cars are outside, in the 70s, you had an even split between red, white, black, gray, green. You know, you never see a green car. You never see a yellow car, right? It's all gray, black, and white, right? And so there's that you know, refinement of you know, removal of diversity in colors, right? Or you look at, you know, homes now. Homes have that gray vinyl flooring, that white, you know, the white walls. Every bathroom looks the same. You know, that was something that started, I think, with the house flippers maybe 20 years ago on TV or whatever. But now almost every home kind of has that layout, and it also has an open layout. And so you're starting to see how things starting to look the same. And logos are a big part of it. When you see all these logo rebrands, and that's getting popular online, they all going for a minimalist font and taking away all the ornate details. You see that in accents too. People, you know, there's a reported lack of accents in America now. That accents are changing, where it kind of, we're kind of speaking all the same in a way, sort of this corporate kind of Midwest, Northern or Midwestern type of English, where you don't even know where people are from. Like, you know, we used to have these New York or Chicago or Californian or Southern, and then diversity within these accents as well. So, and then you see it in sports too. The data analytics revolution in sports. If you watch an NBA game, it's all three pointers or it's all layups or dunks. There's no mid shot game anymore. There's no Jordan, Kobe's kind of guys that just live off that 15 footer. In soccer, you see, I think it was like a 50% reduction in shots outside the goal as well. So it's happening everywhere. I would say in sports, the data analytics guys have figured it out, the style of play that's most efficient. And in other places, you know, it's hard to describe why people are kind of going into one kind of area for every domain. The more connected we are, the less diversity that there is, right? When you look back 100 years ago, there's tons of different types of hats in countries all over, in regions. Now, the baseball hat is the only one around. So, you know, part of it is being connected. Part of it is people want to resell things. So to resell a house, it's got to look like what, you know, a middle-class house that middle-class people want to live in or something. You know, one kind of design. And if you deviate from that, you might be hurting the resale value. So there's a variety of reasons, but ultimately it leads to everything looking the same.
Let's set sports aside for just one moment. I want to devote our own conversation to sports when it comes to refinement culture. But I want to talk about aesthetics and for that matter, accents. Let's start with accents. I love this idea that you're articulating, this concept of refinement culture. I lament it. I don't love it that it's happening. I love that you've given it focus. Intuitively, I love provincialism. I'm from Texas. I love our own unique provincial history. I love our accent. I love the Boston accent. I don't want everyone in America to sound the same, to listen to the same music. It is a bland life. It's a bland country in my own subjective assessment. I don't like it if we all are the same. You know, that one seems to me probably a product, at least the accents, of what you're describing, connection. But then when you go to aesthetics like the homes and the logos, what I wonder is that driven by the bottom up or the top down? Is that driven by connectivity, human beings all connecting with each other and wanting the same thing? Or is that sort of a product of capitalism where the business constantly wants its biggest market? And in order to do so, you got to appeal to the vast majority of people. How do you explain us all wanting and sounding exactly the same?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture. Definitely, there's top-down uniformity happening. To get on TV, you know, you've been on TV for a long time, right? To get on TV, could you speak with a really heavy Southern accent on national TV? I mean, do they even allow? Like, you don't rarely hear that really old style thick kind of accent maybe on television anymore. So there's a top down sort of aesthetic of what people should sound like if they're being broadcast to, you know, the majority of America, you know, and that's something that's been happening in the 20th century for a while. But, you know, now with the internet and people trying to, you know, gain as many followers as possible, they're going to try to chase the biggest market, and chasing the biggest market means sounding the most bland and non-offensive, you know, and non-regional too. So, you know, there's that going on with accents, I think, which, You know, that's unfortunate, because I remember even growing up hearing way more accents than I do today when you go outside, especially in younger folks. What's interesting is you got to focus on this first generation that's coming up, the Zoomers, like the 18 to 25 year olds that are sort of, I'm older than that. So, I still do things the old way, but this generation that sort of grew up in this media environment and is part, is deep into refinement culture and doesn't really know it. You'll see a lack of variety and lack of regional kind of localism there. Yeah, I mean that's ultimately what happens with connection. And then bottom up, yeah, I think people, Facebook Marketplace, selling houses, flipping houses, cars are kind of sold and traded in all the time, and you don't want to take risks, and you don't want to stand out, and you want to just get in there with what's acceptable, what's able to be resold all the time.
If I bought a green truck, my buddies would be like, yeah, nice green truck.
Yeah, you're not going to get much value for it. Even, Elon Musk came out with a crazy design, right? His new Cybertruck, real distinct from everything else, but it's still gray, right? I mean, he's not going to do a green Cybertruck, right? So there's even, it's almost like gray is like the color of our time. Whenever you see these Netflix shows or these filters, it's always has this weird gray filter that maybe old Hollywood didn't have, these like kind of like a brighter, kind of brighter colors. So yeah, there's bottom up as well, which is you're going to lose out on money, or, there's not much to gain from sticking out, yeah, with like a green car, like maybe it used to be. I don't know.
I was just talking last night. One of my kids was at soccer practice. We're going to get into that in just a moment. And I was talking to some dads about this haircut that my son, who's a young teen, has. And you're probably aware, if you are even aware at all of teenagers in America, you're probably aware of the haircut. There's a meme going around it. When did teenagers look at grandma and decide, I want that haircut? All the boys look like a granny. They have this mop flop curl thing, even length all around from front to back. And the fascinating thing about that to me, as I was saying to the other dads, there was this big tournament last year. I live in Dallas, and there's a huge soccer tournament in Dallas every year that brings teams from across the country and internationally. And every team, at least in America, I don't care if you're in the Northeast or you're in the South, every white boy has the same haircut. It doesn't matter, New York or Texas. They all look exactly the same. And you pointed out, yeah, I think it was in one of your posts, for example, my loved home state of Texas. In the 1980s, you gave this stat, 80% of Texans had, I think, a unique accent. And now we're down to like a third reflecting that unique accent.
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere, though. I mean, I grew up in Chicago. You rarely hear that Chicago 1980s Ditka SNL, that stereotype. I mean, that is cut as well. It's all kind of going away. I think, yeah, connection's weird. I don't know if we're meant to be all connected to each other and like this, and it's going to cause strange kind of strange effects. So maybe we're seeing it for right now. Yeah, there's something to be said about localism, preserving identity. And if you don't have that, then, you're all going to go to one side. You're all going to go, and you'll see identity still with the Amish, right? Closed out societies or certain areas of the country that maybe certain people don't go to. And you'll still see strong local variants there. But if you're hyper-connected, that could be a price you pay for hyperconnection, which is losing a little bit of your regional variety.
Can I just follow up on that for one moment? That's fascinating to me. So the more we're connected, the more we become the same, and the more we lose sense of our identity, our unique individual identity, or our unique regional identity. Do you think, Paul, Lindy Man, do you think there is any connection there to sort of this loss of identity and then the responding search for identity? Certainly with young people, there seems to be a crisis of identity. And I, for one, would offer up that I think a lot of what's going on with, gender identity as a response to this, that there's a constant search, maybe for the most unique or radical thing that you can find as a desperate grasp into individuality.
Yeah, that could be. You know, like, this is America, right? So we produce a lot of new things. New identities is one of the things we produce, right? And that gets exported to other places too. So, you know, seeing yourself kind of with in a place that you don't think is special, like locally, regionally, and you look for, you know, either a sexual orientation or certain groups or a certain identity of gender, it could be part of it. Generally, though, you know, in America, that's why I think the Lindy effect is important to have if you're an American, because we don't, you know, we're going forward somewhere. And if you try to remove everything from the past, you know, things are going to get weird. So there's not a lot of guardrails here that maybe other countries that have been around, have deeper cultures may have that, hey, you know, they can balance out their sort of, you know, French culture with new American culture. We don't have that base culture in a way, or maybe we did and that went away, you know, 50 years ago, but, or 20 years ago, but it's important to not be too history blind here, because, you know, it's an exciting country to be in. We're creating the future. We're exporting everything to other countries. They want to be us, but you're going to get, you know, if you get too caught up in it, you know, weird things are going to happen. And, you know, that's why it's good to have something in your back pocket.
No, so you're talking about being untethered from tradition, untethered from history. And in so many ways, the U.S. is. We have a short history. I don't think we are devoid of culture, but we're constantly in a process of trying to either refine or overturn or innovate or revolutionize that culture. And that can lead you to very, very dangerous. I mean, I think, to be clear, dangerous places if you're untethered from wisdom tied to tradition.
More with our guests coming up.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
I want to follow up on this train of thought, because, you know, I was obviously alluding to sort of like transgender ideology. It seems, I'm curious, I'm going to ask you a two-part question on this, okay? It would seem on the surface that is very anti-Lindy, that if I traveled back in time, would I find trans ideology in 14th century Italy? But at the same time, I think it's important for me to understand Lindy a little more carefully, because in reading again about you, what you are saying or what we should take away from this is just because something is old means that it is endorsed, right? I don't think that's what you're saying, because you were talking about, I think, with one interviewer, Jeffrey Epstein, and you were saying, look, immorality and pedophilia are old. That doesn't mean they are right. It just should give you an awareness of human nature. Slavery is old. It's a tradition as old as humankind. I don't think that means that you are endorsing it, right? Just making us aware of reality. So how do you draw a line on this is old and therefore it survived the test of time and it's good versus this is old and we should just be aware that it's part of our nature?
Right. There's a reason why we have laws for certain things, right? Because people are just going to keep doing them if we don't have laws. So, I think you definitely find trans people throughout history. You definitely, maybe not an identity and in a group, sort of a group identity and with a flag, with other identities, and sort of this is kind of new. I mean, you know, obviously, even the conception of a gay person was, if you look at history, was a really Christian creation. There was gay acts, but to be a gay person sort of came in with Christianity once they started defining, what a gay person is, instead of, you know, the traditional masculine pagan idea of, you know, the giver or the taker, right? And so Christianity brought in a complete prohibition on all of that, which we've held, you know, which is held up until the sort of present day. But as Christianity sort of has disappeared from the scene, you know, you could say we live in a post-religious age right now. I don't think that's controversial. You're seeing an emergence of these groups, but as an identity and as game, you know, with a flag. And I think that's sort of new. And I don't think that's ever happened before. There's things that are Lindy, which is, you know, that are maybe not so good, which is, you know, pedophilia, like a certain age, issue with rich guys or powerful men abusing younger women. There's that as well. There's always this moral, so you could say it's a moral revolution that is kind of happening as well, which is, what Harvey Weinstein did was known in the 90s, and has always been practiced, which is the film producer sleeps with the actress who wants to be part of the picture, right? And that's an open secret and nobody cared. And hey, he's making good movies and he has powerful friends. There was, fast forward to recently, there was a bit of there was a large group saying that's not okay anymore. You can't do that. And we had a reckoning in that situation. So there is Lindy effect is there. I don't use it as like a moral crutch or as a moral viewpoint. I sort of take a step back to that because I think society is going to decide what moral avenues it wants to take to prohibit certain things. But on other matters, I think it'd be a lot more useful.
Yes. Okay. I think that is an interesting distinction you just drew. It's not a moral valuation, but perhaps a human. It's hard to separate value from morality, right? But there's something. It's like anything. I remember having this debate one time. I was a contributor at National Review, a conservative magazine, and we were talking about the value of tradition, which is inherently part of conservatism. It is it is what you believe, by the way. It is very much if something has stood the test of time, that in and of itself suggests it has inherent value. And the obvious rebuttal to that is, well, slavery stood the test of time. That doesn't mean it has value. And so it's not to suggest, I think, any of this that you're laying out. I don't think you're suggesting. I'm certainly not buying into the idea that it's a hard and fast rule that you stick and you don't change. But maybe more like a bearing. What you said earlier, a risk or value assessment.
The definition of slavery changes as well. Like the Romans, you could get out of slavery by making money for the owner, right? American slavery was for life and for generations. So even when we use these terms, someone being property is, it was a great moral awakening for us to completely remove that notion. But the notion of slavery resembled employment in the Roman Empire, whereas you can be, if you have too much debt, you got to go into this person's slavery to pay them off, work for them, and then you can get out of slavery and then enter a market. So there's even changes with terminology, but yes, broadly, I think we're better off living in the world where there's certain kind of moral advances, and slavery, being property as a human being is terrible.
Right. Back to refinement culture. I think one of the best illustrations in your post about this is just to see corporate logos over time all become absolutely the same. And you can get a visual illustration of this refinement culture. Let's talk about sports for just one moment. I think this is I think sports best illustrates, I think like you, I am definitely an opponent of refinement culture. I do not enjoy this trend within our culture. That being said, as a sports fan, as a sports commentator for many years, when you talked about sports, I sort of feel torn. Basketball is the best example, I think, that you bring up, how the game has become so monotonously the same. Baseball as well, for that matter, and it's less entertaining. Soccer is interesting to me in that what we saw, I think, actually start in soccer and then bleed over into basketball was, yes, data and really the perfection of the game. And soccer became more beautiful the more they understood the value of the pass and the dissection and the geometry that resulted in more obviously high percentage goals than bombing away from outside the box. It became more intellectual, and that became interesting to me.
Right.
But there was this fascinating term you used where it led me someplace else. Basically, what you're saying is we figured these games out. These games have been figured out.
Yeah. Refinement culture, people, when I post about it online, people think, oh, it's bad. But, it also raises the baseline a little bit. Coffee tastes good anywhere you go right now, because Starbucks came here years ago and put out of business all the bad coffee places. Okay, when you, you know, homes look pretty nice. Airports look nice. Like, yeah, they look the same, but the baseline has gotten better. And I look at that with sports, and it makes me sad that that diversity is gone. You know, and in sports, the play is exciting. You know, seeing that three-pointer, that ball in the air from like 30 feet out, is going to go in, seeing those dunks. This is exciting, you know, and same thing with soccer. The game's much more skilled. The problem is, it's like, you know, eating cookies. You know, cookie tastes good, and that's all we have. We're eating cookies all day, and it's like, I'd like something else, and there's nothing else on the menu. And so it's weird, because if, I guess, casual fans like it all the time, especially with sports. They said the NBA has never been this exciting. And if, yeah, I remember watching the Bulls and in the 90s, and it was a lot of, you know, fouls and, you know, aggressive play. I wouldn't call it beautiful. And, you know, now it does look like beautiful, but that's all there is. And
yeah,
at some point, are people going to get tired of just this, you know, how much beauty, you know, if it doesn't, humans adapt to their environment. So something that's beautiful isn't very beautiful all the time. So.
So that's funny you bring that up. I have a friend the other day who was talking to me about this other friend who was having marital troubles. And he said, well, listen, let me explain to you something. Bob's Steak and Chop House is the best, right? It's wonderful. It's the best steak. Your wife is gorgeous. You have the best wife. That's why you married her. But if you ate Bob's every day, and all you ever had was Bob's Steak and Chop House, one day you're going to see a Tostino's pizza and be like, I really want that Tostino's pizza. It's objectively not as good, but variety is a spice of life. And therefore, by the way, when it comes to marriage, that's not an endorsement of infidelity. That just is a reflection of the virtue of overcoming that instinct when it comes to monogamy. But variety is the spice of life. And it's really not a, it's not a value judgment or indictment on beauty or value.
Absolutely. That's the thing. Variety is very important. Ask any rich person. They have multiple homes. Why? Because they want to live in just one place. They want to live in other places, explore, you know, engage with other environments. And when you get the super rich people, they don't even have a home. They're just constantly, you know, circumvading the globe and doing whatever they want. So, variety is the spice of life, and we all look for it. In many ways. And if we don't get it, you know, I'm waiting to see when the other shoe drops. You know, how many more years of the NBA playing like this before they institute rules? We just saw that with baseball. Baseball set up a clock, which is crazy to me, because this is the only game, right, that doesn't have clocks, that is supposed to be the permanent summer, school's out. But they had a refinement culture issue. They had managers bring in pitchers all the time. And when you bring in, you know, I think they're using like 8 pitchers a game. And every time you bring in a new pitcher, you have to go to commercials. And then you have to have, you know, him warm up. And, you know, the game is more efficient with utilizing all these pitchers, but it's 4 hours long and people can't handle it. So now they had to implement, you know, clocks. They had to, you know, instead of, they had to change the game because the game's been figured out.
That is the phrase I keep coming back to, though. So, you know, I don't know if you know much about my career. I spent 5 years at ESPN talking sports every day for 3 hours a day with my own radio show, and loved this sort of philosophical, intellectual approach to sports. And I would have told you at that time, well, it's cyclical. And for every revolution, there's a counter revolution. And so they figured this game out, and, you know, whatever. If the passing game in football becomes too pronounced, some defense is going to figure out, all I got to do is draft defensive backs and run dime package. And then the counter revolution to that will be, we're going to revert back to the old school running game. And it's just constant chess. But you've used this phrase, it's been figured out, which made me think in a different way. Is there a point at which all of these games, these sports, become fully optimized and figured out, and there's no more revolutions, and that what we actually enjoy is the beginning sort of entrepreneurial phase of these sports, the figuring of them out? And so what we really need for that variety, for that diversity of sport, is a new sport. Like, we're all going to be watching pickleball in 10 years because we're still trying to figure out which makes the best pickleball player and the best pickleball strategy.
That's interesting. That could happen if there's a lane open for, I almost think that the UFC came by and is so crazy and brutal. And you know, look, not everybody in America can handle seeing another guy just get beaten up like that, but it's gotten a pretty good share because it's so wild and so unpredictable. And I think that sort of appeals to a certain amount of people. And you could see other sports come in through, you know, that could be right. But I don't think these sports are going to give up. Like, I think they're going to change the environment. I think they're going to change the field. I think if you put up, you know, you could play around with, you know, you can move the 3-point line back. You know, you could institute. I think changes are coming, though. And I don't think, yeah, it could be cyclical, but I don't think we're, I think they figured it out. I don't think things are going to change. Now I'm just waiting for the rule changes. But yeah, this is a great
opportunity. I love that you brought up UFC, because I think what we actually saw with UFC is refinement culture in hyperspeed. If you'll remember the early 90s UFC, the bit was, hey, how does a jiu-jitsu master go up against a boxer, go up against a wrestler, go up against, you know, a sumo wrestler? It was vastly different guys, and which style wins. And now it's mixed martial arts. It's taken the best of each of those, right? And pretty much every fighter is of the same multi-discipline approach when it comes to UFC. It's been refined like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's exciting to actually see that in real time, which is to go from a wrestling specialist to a boxing guy to now everybody has to learn the same things and have, you know, have certain things, you know, fight similar way. I still think it's still a raw sport. There's still a lot of, you know, it's still new. So it may take more time. And so, you know, the nature of it is, you know, if you get hit once, it's over. So I don't know how, especially at the heavyweight level, we might not even see that fully be refined because it's just so chaotic. But yeah, we saw a sport come in and refine itself in like 15 years, which probably took other sports longer time.
One more thing on sports. It seems like the ultimate, though, disruptor when it comes to refinement is size. So in other words, what we've seen in almost every sport, football, basketball, and I think even soccer, is that over time, size begins to accompany athleticism more and more, and you have to adapt to that. So Messi is a massive aberration. You know, it sounds like you do follow soccer to some extent. Like, there's a guy, Manchester City, Erling Haaland. Erling Haaland from Manchester City seems to be like, he's not just a great player. He seems to be the future. He's huge and athletic and fast, and everybody has to adjust to that. In basketball, we've gotten to the point where, you know, Steph Curry is a little bit of an aberration as well. We're just seeing 6'10 guys become ball handlers, become 3-point shooters. And in a way, it becomes very sameness refined, where it's everybody's sort of a big wing. But at the same time, you have to adjust to this growth in the human size and athleticism.
Well, yeah, it also brings up an aesthetic, you know, it almost looks like a circus now, because I mean, you get 7-foot guy. I mean, if you look at the original Olympics, that was just, you know, people in your town, even the first few modern Olympics were amateurs, and literally amateurs, you know, you had a day job, and we went through a professionalization era, right? And then, you know, you had people, you know, people make fun of Michael Jordan because he didn't play against great competition like today. And you look at those 90 games, those games in the 90s, and you're like, wow, these guys are pretty athletic and tall. And then you look at the guys now, and it's, you know, 7-foot players shooting 3-pointers, can do everything. They all can do everything. And we're getting athletes because of how much money it is and how global sports are. We're getting like 1 in a billion type people into these playing these sports, and they're all playing together. And, you know, I wonder how long until we see like just mass injury crisis, or something's got to give, because we're so optimized now that, you know, it also kind of looks like, you know, it looks kind of a little bizarre. Like, everybody is almost not, you know, unhuman. Like we've gone way past the original Olympics, you know? So, you know, we had that with steroids, with baseball, but I don't know, in the 90s, and it was very entertaining. I don't know what's going to stop this. We're finding the 1 in like 4 billion person who is 7 foot tall and shoot perfect threes. Like,
they seem to be getting more common, those people. Yeah. So I want to talk about stuck culture too. So, I think anybody listening, is you can't live life without seeing that things are, or were, cyclical, you know. Right now in fashion, we seem to be firmly entrenched in the 90s. You know, bell bottoms are back, flannels are back. It's a couple years ago, everybody was dressing pretty much in the 80s. By the way, everyone's wearing baggy jeans as well. So it's very 90s. And, you know, we're in the 80s. And then I'm a child of the 90s. When we went through this phase, bell bottoms were like, oh, 70s are back. Right. But you've said something happened, you know, in the past. I don't even know what your time frame is. 2005, mid 2000s. We just stopped this thing where we have like the world at our fingertips for diversity, but yet we've stopped changing and all look the same.
So, yeah. So you saw the Super Bowl. You saw a lot of commercials there referencing things from, you know, when you were 18 or 20 or less. And it was the 90s, right? And, you know, from the 40s to the 2006, 2007, we were all consuming the same media. We were all, you know, decades would change. 70s didn't look like 80s, didn't look like 90s. It's just, you know, music, fashion, words. We're all part of a common monoculture. Everybody knew all the celebrities. Everybody was listening to the same thing. Everybody knew, you know, what was happening. And fast forward to the mid to late 2000s, all these social media companies came out. You know, culture decentralized a little bit. Now you can go and you can watch YouTube. You can look at a podcast. And, you know, the people around you may not be, you know, consuming the same media. And you see this with TV ratings. TV ratings are going down. Award show ratings are going down. You look at the movies. Everything's a sequel, right? Everything is just a duplication of what it came. And this isn't normal times, right? This isn't like the 20th century where, you know, you're consuming new art every decade and going through changes. My theory is twofold. One is that we are in a stuck culture era at the mainstream level. Now there's tons of interesting stuff going on in the internet or, you know, at smaller scale, but at the bigger scale to reach everybody, mainstream culture has just stayed the same. And I'm going to disagree with you. I think if you went back in time to 2011, 2010, I don't think anybody would know you're a time traveler from 2023. I don't think they, from the way you dress, from the way you talk, your phone probably, but I generally don't think we're seeing these changes. And, you know, look at the, you know, every movie is a sequel. And I think for two reasons. One, this internet decentralized, and also algorithms. So everything is an algorithm now, right? Everything, every screen you look at is being programmed for your, you know, based on your past preferences. And your past preferences aren't going to be able to create a completely new aesthetic or new media, new music. It's just going to be derivations of what you consumed before. So I think we can't actually escape the era we're in, because everything around us is a byproduct of what we've consumed in the past.
If I wore my athleisure back to 2011, they might be like, what's up? Yeah, that, you know, and I make a joke about
that. No, they were wearing athleisure back then. You don't think athleisure was big in 2000?
I don't know. Lululemon and Vuori and everything that everyone's wearing that's perfectly refined.
Pants.
Hey,
women walking around yoga pants?
I don't think
maybe
you're
not
wrong.
Men, but...
Yeah, not men. Maybe. See, there you go.
Well, there's small changes, but generally it's not. Look at pictures of the 80s. Look at pictures of the 90s. All right. And I don't think we're seeing that change where you go, wow, there's like a huge difference here. I think something's happening here. Things have slowed down a lot.
But at the let's play devil's advocate to vet that out for a moment. Well, I don't think I have a disagreement with you, even though I make the joke about athleisure. Well, I don't think I have a disagreement with you about, say, fashion. I'd ask one thing and offer a rebuttal. The thing I would ask is, do you think you're capable of knowing and seeing change as it's happening around you? Or can you only really see it in retrospect? So, you know, if you dropped somebody in the 90s, you know, at that time, would you have said there's nothing new or unique about the 90s? We're just redoing the 70s and we're stuck, you know. And I just wonder if while we're in it in real time, are we capable of seeing how we are at that moment unique? But let me offer you this as well. You respond to it again. While the fashion might be a joke, ideologically, like what we are, human American culture transported to 2011 is vastly different.
like vastly different. I think, you know, the ideas that we have today that we debate, that we discuss. Look, we talk about Barack Obama went from opposed to gay marriage to one of the leading advocates of gay marriage in a 5-year time frame. If you went back and introduced these trans debates we're having today to somebody from 2011, their mind would be blown. I think at least on the deeper levels, we're in hyperspeed change.
Okay. I think in the politics bubble, there is movement. Yes. And I think there's certain bubbles have advanced more than other bubbles. But if an average person who's, let's say, not, you know, a politics person, doesn't consume politics content, it's just, hey, I'm going to go to the theater. What's playing at the theater today? What am I putting on for my clothes? What am I going to go eat? You know, what are we going to do for a holiday? You know, what are we going to do where are we going to drive to? I generally think you don't see tons of changes in that realm like we've had in the past. Now, I think, yeah, if you want to get to, you know, certain acceleration of political correctness, which I think was something I remember in the 90s that has sort of kind of enveloped into what we call woke culture now. Yeah, that's accelerated. But generally, what we're consuming is, I don't think that much different, and what we're doing is very much different than the changes we saw in the 20th century. Now, I think the 20th century may be the one that was fake. Everybody doing the same thing around the country, consuming the same thing and then changing every decade seems a little artificial. It could have been coming from the top down. Hmm. Perhaps, you know, styles didn't change as quickly. Culture didn't change as quickly in hundreds of years ago. So we're in maybe a more normal state,
right?
But normal as mediated by the internet. But generally, no. I mean, we should be wearing radically different things today. We should be, you know, there should be radically different movies or music on the TV or on the top 100. But I don't know, man. It looks all similar to me at that level. Obviously, there's.
I wonder if those two things are connected. Actually, you know, I wonder. You know, I sit here. Because I actually don't even think it's necessarily political. I think it is cultural and where our minds are and the things that we consider and the things that we debate. You know, it seems counterintuitive that the broader amount of choice that you have, the more monolithic you become, right? You point out 70s and 90s, you had a smaller menu of choices and we had more diversity seemingly. Today, we have a world of choice at our fingertips, and we are more monolithically the same. That's counterintuitive. But because we are herd animals and we are all connected, maybe we coalesce on the superficial levels into sort of this sameness while rebelling within ourselves against that for these more radical thoughts. And I even think it's reflected, and I'm not here to, I look at my son or kids who, you know, gravitate towards Andrew Tate, right? Or somebody like that. And it's like, that is, I think one of the appeals of that to young men is the diversity of thought it represents or offers compared to the monolithic thought they might be taught in formal settings. So I almost think like what's going on inside might be getting a little more diverse and rebellious, while on the outside, we get more shallow and same.
Yeah, I mean, I think Andrew Tate exists because in the 90s, you didn't need him. Like, the culture was geared toward young men. I mean, it was kind of vulgar. I mean, everything was kind of geared. Like, the movies were good. I don't know. I mean, you know, you saw stuff like Pulp Fiction, Fight Club, Matrix, Howard Stern's Ascendance. And, you know, it was offensive comedy was accepted, and that was fine. And I think we've switched, and I think woke culture is in a way is the exact opposite of all that, which is, you don't offend anybody. And, you know, now if you're a young guy, you have to go to the internet to find somebody, you know, who's speaking to you. And so you have all these sort of these kind of like social media stars appealing to this big group of boys or men, people like Jordan Peterson, because there's nothing out there in the mainstream anymore. But I don't think there's been anything out there for the past 15 years, 20 years for men in the mainstream. So.
All right, let's I'd love to land the plane by coming back full circle and just talk about what I think really there's many aspects of your thought process and your writing that appeal to me. But I think the most important takeaway is I think I use this word to describe what you're talking about, which is wisdom. And wisdom is accumulated knowledge over time. You know, I think it's knowledge not divorced from maybe value or virtue. And it seems to be that what you're suggesting, I think, accurately. And there's others who have taken up this mantle in different niches, like you point out Carnivore MD when it comes to diet, right? Let's talk about what people ate throughout time versus Cheetos. I'm forgetting his name, but I listened to a guy yesterday on a podcast talking about nutrients instead of these medicines that we take over and over that we're missing. He's talking about the value of sunlight and being physically grounded to the earth and breathing, just things that people have done for centuries. What I'd love to return to is this. How, maybe it's you defining heuristic for us. How do you view this as an instinct, as a risk assessment model, as a hard and fast rule, as a principle? How do you use accumulated wisdom? How do you use history to help guide you to a better tomorrow, to a better life?
I'm not optimistic that everything going forward is a progress. You could be caught up in something, in a trend, and this trend could be 70, 80 years. And if you get into it, you lose everything. I mean, obviously, maybe your life, but maybe your sanity, maybe your well-being, you know. And I look at it as something, you know, I look at 20th century American food culture as a great example of this. American food culture wasn't that good. It was canned food, TV dinners. It was a lot of crap. It was a lot of stuff that immigrant families from poverty-stricken countries would come to America, the richest country in the world, and say, this is what they're eating. Our food back home was terrible, right? And because America was in the midst of this sort of, you know, industrialized food and efficiency and, you know, make it as quick as possible. And both people are working and, you know, we got to come home and, you know, what's convenient. And then the late 90s happened and there was a fresh revolution, right? Whole Foods moved in, Starbucks moved in. You know, we brought back Lindy. We brought back, you know, freshness and health. And you know, this was helped by, you know, liberals in big cities who are health optimizers. This was, you know, this is brought in by a number of different, you know, groups in America who have different, you know, ideologies, even vegetarians and carnivore people came by. But they all sort of tried to bring back a better food culture for people. And through this destruction and creation process, we have, you know, we can have healthy options everywhere. In every town over like 100,000 people, you can find good food now. So, but if you were in like 1982 America and you thought that this food is what's normal, like I would say that's incorrect. That's wrong. You'd have to have another filter to get yourself out of the time period you're in. And so, you know, I use it very casually, very loosely. It's not a hard and fast rule. It's not some, you know, something I adhere to. It's just something in the back of your mind that asks you, you know, what about our environment has changed and how will this affect me? And I may still do it. I may still have a cigarette, but I may not, but I probably won't get addicted to smoking cigarettes. So there is something there in the back of your head that people can utilize. And it's a catchy word. It's called Lindy. It's a nice word. It comes with, you know, a nice heuristic and some math behind it. And I think it'd be useful for people to get out of the time period they're in, and maybe other people trying to sell you something or bring you into an environment that you may not be good for you.
I love it. I've really enjoyed your writing. I appreciate this conversation, including the back and forth. And I give it my endorsement. I co-sign this value and wisdom of time and tradition. I hope we can talk again. Paul Scalise, Lindy Man, thank you.
Thank you, Will. It's very nice speaking to you.
There you go. Once again, follow Paul on Twitter at Paul Scalise, SKALLAS, where you can subscribe to his newsletter, Lindy newsletter, at .beehive.com. As for me and you, I'll see you again next time.
Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.